Well, good morning. We really have a full house today for our last day of arguments during the month of February. Before I call the case, my notes here tell me that we have some students visiting from Maranatha Baptist University. If they are here, would they and their advisors please stand? Wonderful. Oh, very, very nice. Thank you. You may be seated. The students are here in a program that we operate in conjunction with the State Bar of Wisconsin called Court with Class. So they've had some information provided to them before they came to see us today. And today, if you can stick around, one of the justices, and today it will be I who will speak with you at the noon break. So if you can stick around, please do, and everyone else, of course, is welcome. We won't talk about the substance of the cases that we are going to hear today, but really talk a little bit about how the Supreme Court fits within our judicial system in Wisconsin and how it relates to the federal judicial system. Since I have had a look at you standing, I would like to introduce the court to all of you as well. On my far right, Justice Rebecca Bradley. Next to her, Justice Annette Ziegler. Next to me, Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. The chair next to her is the one occupied by Justice Michael Gableman, who has been delayed but will be joining us shortly. And on the far left is Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those remarks, I think we're set to go. State versus Steinhardt. Are you ready to proceed? Please do.
Good morning, Justices, and may it please the Court. The ultimate question before you today is not as complicated as it may seem. We are here to decide whether Heather L. Steinhardt was subjected to multiple punishments for a single offense. I believe that answer is yes. Now, because we are in a post-conviction posture, the court then must consider if and how this multiplicity violation can be remedied. This requires the court to determine whether Ms. Steinhardt relinquished or forfeited her right to raise the multiplicity issue by pleading no contest to the charges before the court. I believe that because the multiplicity claim can be resolved on its face, and in accordance with State versus Kelty, that Ms. Steinhardt did not relinquish those rights and can file a challenge with the appellate court and that can be granted in her favor. A post-conviction multiplicity challenge is a legal question and one that the court reviews de novo. Also presented to this court in the petition for review is a question related to Ms. Steinhardt's pleadings regarding her ineffective assistance of counsel claim. The question was, did Ms. Steinhardt sufficiently allege that she was prejudiced by her attorney's failure to advise her of the multiplicity issue? I believe that her pleadings were sufficient regarding prejudice, and the state is in agreement with that in their brief before this court. I will rely upon my brief and will not address that in greater detail unless the court has specific questions regarding that claim. Now, before moving forward, I would like to clarify that this is a multiplicity challenge. And that it's really a due process challenge. I think that the waters are a little bit muddied in some of the briefs. This is not specifically a constitutional double jeopardy claim. This is by no means a dispositive clarification. I don't think that the argument rises and falls on that point at all, but I did want to just make sure that the court was aware of that this is not a double jeopardy claim that rises and falls in the Blockberger analysis.
Now, well, what's the analysis for due process?
Well, I believe it's really the same analysis. The questions are, is it identical in law and is it identical in fact? And since it is a due process question, we would be conceding essentially that it's not identical in law in the meaning of Blockberger. The elements are not identical. One is not a lesser included offense based on the elements only test. What changes, I guess I should say, in a due process challenge versus a double jeopardy challenge is then who bears the burden of showing that the legislature intended or did not intend to have multiple punishments for a single act. In a due process challenge, it would be the defendant, or in this situation, Ms. Steinhardt, who would have to bear the burden of showing that the legislature did not intend for multiple punishments in this case. The ultimate question, though, the initial question is the same. Are they identical in law? And the most important question, are they identical then in fact? Now, a post-conviction challenge to a conviction based on multiplicity relies...
Sorry.
That's all right. It relies heavily on the facts of the case. In this case, we're talking about three convictions. She was charged and convicted of failure to act to prevent an act of child sexual assault, first-degree sexual assault of a child as party to a crime, and child enticement. In this case, what the court must look at is what the court had before it at the time the plea was entered, the record as it existed on its face at the time the plea was taken. In this case,
what other part of the record could you look at here with a no contest? The sentencing?
I'm sorry.
What other part of the record could you look at here with a record? Because it was no contest. So the only other record would be the sentencing record.
I think that is true. I think the record for consideration related to a multiplicity claim is the record as it stood at the time of the plea. I think that there can be additional information that does come out at a sentencing. I don't think it would be appropriate for the court to consider that regarding its consideration of really what Ms. Steinhardt knew at the time she entered the plea.
So what's the record at the time of entering the plea?
In this case, I think there's an agreement between the parties that the record really only contains the criminal complaint. The criminal complaint here contains about six sentences that outline Ms. Steinhardt's substantive behavior. There was no oral amendment or an oral offer of proof that the court requested or that the parties offered on their own volition. So what we're really dealing with here is simply the criminal complaint. I think in other cases it can be potentially additional information if there are motion hearings and a preliminary hearing and other information that the court had before it, but those are not situations that exist here. It's just the criminal complaint.
Counsel, can I ask you to back up just a moment? You mentioned that that you could prevail on a due process argument as well as double jeopardy. Did you make a due process argument in your briefs?
Well, I think that the I wanted to clarify that for the court because I think the argument is the same. It's just in more of the recent cases in Davison and some of the newer cases, the court clearly distinguishes that just as far as phrasing, double jeopardy is related to an elements-only analysis of the Blockberger analysis, so the constitutional right against double jeopardy, but that there's also a due process protection. It's the same analysis, and it's discussed in all of the I think really all of the cases on double jeopardy or multiplicity, I think they really use those terms interchangeably in some of the older cases. They've cleaned up that language.
Did you make the distinction between a double jeopardy analysis and a due process analysis in your briefs?
No. I don't think that there's ever, I think the terms are used really interchangeably. I think we do get into, though, the burden, where the burden falls as far as the legislative intent, and that's really the important part of a due process challenge versus a double jeopardy challenge, who the burden falls upon.
Well, the burden is determined, is it not, by the first prong in the double jeopardy analysis, correct?
Yes. And that's the same analysis that would apply in a due process violation as well. Are the is it identical in law, and is it identical in fact?
And your position on whether it is identical in law is what?
I think that to be clear, I did represent this in my opening brief, it's not identical in law in terms of Blockberger. It is a legislatively created lesser included offense, and that's why technically it's a due process violation. But the analysis is the same, at least as far as the is it identical in fact and is it identical in law. If they're not identical in law, the burden then shifts to the defendant to show that the legislature didn't intend for multiple punishments for a single act.
And for purposes of your argument this morning, are you what are you saying about the burden with respect to whether this is identical in law? Are you saying that you do bear the burden on because of that prong because they are not identical?
I think that that is correct, that we would bear the burden, and depending on which way the states, or I'm sorry, in, depending on which version of facts we're talking about, and I don't like to say that version of facts because I think there is only one proper application of facts, but we did offer in our reply brief, and we requested that the court consider invoking the doctrine of judicial estoppel regarding the state's argument. The reason we asked the court to do that is because at the Court of Appeals level, the state took a specific position on the facts of the case, that this is a continuous course of conduct challenge, and that they stipulated essentially that there was that these charges were identical in law under 93966 subsection 2P. The state then, in its brief to this court, changes their idea of which facts apply to which charge, which then alters the way the multiplicity claim should be decided and how the court should look at that. It alters the burden. So we would ask the court to not consider the state's new position on the facts because the Court of Appeals relied on its the Court of Appeals relied upon its original position in making its ruling in the Steinhardt case, and then when this court adopted our petition for review and granted our petition for review, those questions that the court was interested in are relying upon that initial argument and that the Court of Appeals decision and the petition for review and our opening brief. So there is this new version of facts, and I'm asking that the court not consider that.
You talk about new version of facts. Are we also having a new version of law? Didn't the Court of Appeals rely on an asserted double jeopardy claim in its analysis? And isn't a good part, or a part, maybe not a good part, a part of your brief focused on a double jeopardy claim?
That is correct. The Court of Appeals, when they ruled against Ms. Steinhardt, was using the double jeopardy analysis and essentially accepted that the state had conceded that this is identical in law. So the Court of Appeals opens its decision saying that the parties agree that these are identical in law, then the question becomes, are they identical in fact? So the Court of Appeals then gets into the state's propositions about what facts apply to which charge. And this, the Court of Appeals relies on those facts that were put forth by the state, and you can see that in its reference to the State versus Hirsch case, talking about the criminal complaint lacks information relating to the time. That's an argument that the state put forth. And then in the closing paragraph of the Court of Appeals decision, it also says the state put forth all these additional facts that weren't in the record at the time of the plea. The court's not going to outline those here, but that's why this case can't be decided on the record.
With regard to the facts, you've indicated a concession vis-a-vis the, your position on the law. It wasn't clear to me in your reply brief what you meant, and I'm wondering if this is a concession on the facts. In the middle part of page 3, you say, had the state taken the position it now asserts before this court, the passage of time between the events would have been irrelevant as Ms. Steinhardt's actions would have two distinct volitional.
That is a typo. It should say acts at the end of that.
Yeah, that's what I was surprised it didn't because I've read this several times and I've always read acts right into it, so I understand that. What do you mean by that? What are you conceding, if anything, with that statement?
Well, I think that the state is arguing that that there are two acts, that the leading FG to the bedroom is one, and that the sitting by is another. I think if the state were to argue that and take that position, I think that there can be a belief that those are two separate acts. I don't think that that resolves the multiplicity violation or the multiplicity claim. I think it just creates a different multiplicity claim.
Is this a concession of a difference in facts?
Well, I think that I believe that it's the state's position. I think the court could interpret it that way. I think there still is I think you can see this as a continuous course of conduct because she doesn't take a different volitional act. Maybe that was poor phrasing, but she leads FG to the bedroom and sits on the bed while it happens. So could you divide those? I think that there is the state is saying you can divide those. And I think that, I guess, more of what I was trying to get at, the state's new position really turns this into a cumulative offense challenge, or at least their position is that this is a cumulative offense challenge, not a continuous course of conduct challenge, and I think that that's in part what I was trying to get at.
But you're not conceding distinct facts, are you? In other words, that they're not the same in fact. I just didn't know exactly what you meant by that. I thought maybe it was a concession.
I'm not conceding that. I do think that it could be interpreted that way, and that's certainly the state's position. I think that it still should be decided as a continuous course of conduct challenge and taken as that. I think that that's what the facts, how they appropriately fit the charges, that's what the state argued at the Court of Appeals, and that's what we argued in our opening brief, that this is a continuous course of conduct challenge.
Counsel, I'd like to pick up on Justice Bradley's line of questioning and direct you to page 14 of your brief, where I thought I found a concession of factual distinction. It's in the first full paragraph. I'll start midway through the first sentence. Ms. Steinhardt's role in the assault can only logically be divided into two parts. First, Ms. Steinhardt walked FG into the bedroom to Walter for the purpose of a sexual assault. And second, she sat on the bed and remained in that position during the incident. How is that not a concession that this is not one continuous factual scenario?
Well, I think it's one continuous factual scenario. I think there's only one volitional action there. It's bringing the child to the bedroom. She remains there while it happens. It's a continuous course of conduct. She doesn't take any affirmative action forward at that point.
Volitional can be passive as well, could it not?
I think it can be. I think that that's what failure to act can mean.
Right. So if the question that we must answer in determining whether this is one continuous stream of conduct is whether she needed to form two volitions, it seems that your statement here on page 14 indicates that there were two volitions. One, to bring FG into the room, which required an affirmative volitional act, and the second, which is sitting on the bed doing nothing when she had a duty to do something, which would be a second volitional act, although passive. Is there any reason we couldn't analyze it in that way?
Well, I think that when you just look at failure to act as just the title heading, I think it's easy to say failure to act is just sitting on the bed. When you actually look at the charge, or that these are two distinct acts and not a continuous course of conduct, the way failure to act is actually charged in this case is the failure to take action but creating an unreasonable risk of the sexual contact occurring. I think that the whole stream of events, bringing an FG to the room, is creating that unreasonable risk that a sexual assault is going to occur. I think that even if the court were to decide that there are two volitional acts here, I don't think that that is something that would say that Ms. Steinhardt has no claim. I think it just then creates a different multiplicity claim that is addressed in my reply brief. The reason I think that there still exists a multiplicity claim, it is different than what was presented at the Court of Appeals level and was briefed in the opening brief. I think that there still is this multiplicity claim if you look at State versus Church. I think if you apply that reasoning and look at what State versus Church was talking about, that what the court was trying to do and what the legislature was trying to do in enacting a child enticement statute was really to prohibit and to make illegal the act of bringing a child into the bedroom.
Well, there's a difference sometimes between what a legislature intends and what it does, right? So let's take a look at what was pled in the information and to which Ms. Steinhardt pled guilty. Said that on or about this date, Ms. Steinhardt, with intent to have sexual intercourse with the child, did cause a child, FG, who had not attained the age of 18, going through the world, right? So this would be factually distinct because count three alleges that Ms. Steinhardt was going to have sexual relations with FG, right?
That's correct. Okay. I was not original counsel in this case. I do think that there was potentially an issue with the way this was charged that was not represented earlier, so I didn't brief it for the court. Mm-hmm. I think that that is maybe something that is not supported by probable cause in the complaint, because there is no allegation she has any intent. It wasn't charged party to a crime. But I just wanted to note that for the court, because the court did just point that out.
Right. So, but your argument in your reply brief was that if we accept the state's version of how it applies the facts to the charges, that it would create a separate multiplicity issue, and that multiplicity issue would be with the child enticement charge.
Correct.
But the child enticement charge is neither identical in fact or in law, is it?
I think it is identical in fact, but not in law, and that's where it becomes a due process challenge.
All right. So now, if it's, but that just puts you back in the same place. If it's not, for it to be multiplicitous, it has to be identical in fact and in law. Yes?
No. In a due process violation, it does not need to be identical in law, but fine, it does have to be in fact.
And where in your brief do you discuss that?
In my opening brief or my reply brief?
Any brief.
Opening? I'm sorry.
Any brief. Take your pick.
On page 9 of my opening brief, my heading is Ms. Steinhardt committed a single act, and therefore counts 1 and 2 are identical in fact. And then my brief goes on to discuss that.
But where in your brief do you say that there would be a due process violation even if there is a lack of identity, either in fact or in law?
In my reply brief, I think that is the basis of the reply brief, that the multiplicity challenge is not remedied. There still would exist a multiplicity challenge. It would just be a different multiplicity challenge.
I understand. Your multiplicity challenge is because you would say it would be multiplicitous with count three. What I'm getting at is, where are you saying in your briefs that even though two charges might be distinct, either in fact or in law, it would still create a due process violation? Where is that?
I don't know if I specifically make that statement. I mean, the court in Church, the court in Patterson and Durango, they were considering those issues. I guess I didn't specifically state that is a due process violation.
In your reply brief, you don't mention due process at all, do you?
I don't mention that term, due process. I think the cases use the terms multiplicity and due process violation interchangeably. It was Davidson that just specifically noted that the term due process challenge is related to multiplicity challenges. A double jeopardy violation is a constitutional challenge that applies to situations where they're identical in law and fact. I think it's just a term of art. The law itself, the tests that are utilized, they are the same. It's just in recent case law, the court has termed the two different challenges differently.
Counsel, I asked you what difference does it make whether you label it multiplicity or due process, and you said who bears the burden, and that's on the legislative intent, isn't that right?
Correct.
We haven't even gotten to that. So by raising due process, it's one of the issues, but not all of them, and the issues are the same as to identical in law and fact, in both due process and in multiplicity, right?
Yes.
That's your argument as I understand it. Now, this question about identical in law, isn't that covered by 93966 paren 2 per p paren, which says that a crime which is less serious or equally serious under 94802, you can't charge both?
Correct.
You're gone. That's gone. They can't charge both under 93966 for two crimes under 948.02, right?
Yes.
Well, two crimes charged here under 948.02?
Yes, they were. Failure to act and first-degree sexual assault of a child as party to a crime are both violations of 948.02.
So why doesn't this end it?
I think I think it does. My point in talking about the differences in terminology for due process and double jeopardy was just to clarify that for the court.
I don't think it clarified. What it did, it raised the issue of whether or not that issue was waived or forfeited or whatever you want to call it, for not raising it previously. I mean, that's why you're getting these questions. At the same time that you're saying that the state has changed its position, looks like you've changed your position. So if I were you, I would stick to your position. All right. So why are we here under 939.662P?
Well, this in our argument in the opening brief, we talk about that these charges are identical in law and identical in fact, and identical in law based on legislative creation.
All right.
Under 939.66 subsection 2P.
All right. What about fact? Now, the facts here are you've got an event pre-sexual contact with the child or sexual assault and the observance of the sexual assault. Isn't that right?
Yes.
And so it's your view is that's one continuous act, therefore...
Correct.
One crime. The state's view is that there are two acts, right?
Yes.
And therefore, two crimes, and 2P is irrelevant.
Yes.
That's right. There are cases in sexual assault not involving a 948.02, and they seem to cut on timing, how long it takes.
Yes.
Right? So if it's short time, continuous, one crime. Several acts, separated by time, several crimes. Right?
Yes.
So how can we tell? You said that we looked at at the complaint. That's not right. We're looking at the information. Is that right? Did she plead to the complaint or the information?
She pled to the information, but the actual probable cause portion is only contained in the criminal complaint, and that's what the judge inquired about at the time of the plea.
Okay. So what does the complaint or information say about timing?
The complaint has no discussion of timing.
And the information?
It has no probable cause section, so it contains nothing.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may proceed. You might want to be assured that the mic is high enough for you because we have real problems hearing in here. Thank you.
May it please the court. Deputy Solicitor General Kevin Leroy on behalf of Wisconsin. Petitioner is challenging two offenses under the Double Jeopardy Clause, failure to act to protect a child from sexual assault and sexual assault of a minor as party to a crime. She pleaded guilty to these offenses, so under the guilty plea waiver rule, her double jeopardy challenge can only succeed if the record at the time of her plea conclusively establishes a double jeopardy violation. But since the record here does not show there is a double jeopardy problem, her claims fail. So her double jeopardy claim is that the state improperly divided the same offense into multiple charges. The test for this type of claim is provided by the Ziegler case, and that says multiple criminal charges violate double jeopardy when first, the charges are identical in law and fact, and second, the legislature did not intend to allow multiple punishments. The Ziegler case describes this test as coming from both the Double Jeopardy Clause and the Due Process Clause. The first component is a double jeopardy inquiry, usually guided by the Blockberger test. The first component of the question of identical in law is usually guided by the Blockberger test, and the question of fact is guided by a multi-step inquiry that the Ziegler case provides. The second prong of Ziegler test comes from the Double Jeopardy Clause, and that's an inquiry in legislative intent. And this is a recognition that the ability to define crimes belongs to the legislature alone. So even if the legislature does not comply with the Blockberger test, which is a court-created test to measure identical in law, under most circumstances, the legislature may still provide for multiple punishments, or conversely, may only provide for single punishments. So that's where the different due process and double jeopardy components come. It's one claim, a multiplicity claim, two components, double jeopardy inquiry, due process inquiry. So applying the first prong of Ziegler here, so this is the double jeopardy inquiry, the state conceded that they were identical in law by virtue of the statute that Your Honors have been discussing, but they are not identical in fact. Steinhardt escorted her daughter into the bedroom where her husband was waiting, fully knowing he intended to sexually assault her. She then sat on the bed and watched while her husband sexually assaulted her daughter in three distinct ways. She did nothing to stop him, and she admitted to all of this at her plea hearing. So the first charge is failure to act. That is established when a parent knows someone intends to have or is having sexual contact with her child, fails to take action that could prevent the contact, and the failure exposes the child to an unreasonable risk of contact or facilitates the contact. Here, this can be satisfied by Steinhardt waiting on the bed and watching while her husband sexually assaulted her daughter three times. Now, the second charge is sexual assault of a minor as party to a crime. This is established when someone intentionally aids or abets another person to have sexual contact with a person under 13 years old. Here, this can be satisfied by Steinhardt bringing her daughter into the bedroom to her husband, knowing he intended to sexually assault her. So the acts are different in fact, and Ziegler provides the multiple criteria to look at. First, they are different in nature, these actions. One is an act of commission, one is an act of omission. They result in new pain or humiliation to the victim. Steinhardt first delivered her daughter to her attacker and then watched and did nothing as the attacker sexually assaulted her daughter three times. Now, the time span is not discussed in the criminal complaint or the information, but ambiguity on time has to be resolved in favor of upholding the conviction because of the guilty plea waiver rule. And then finally, which I think is the most important criteria in this component of the test here, is the new volitional departure. Steinhardt chose to escort her daughter into the room, then chose to sit on the bed, and then chose to not interfere three times. So affirming the conviction here is perfectly consistent with the Ziegler case and with Eich, both from this court. And
Ms. Steinhardt pled guilty to first-degree sexual assault as party to a crime, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the party to a crime component requires that she aid or abet the commission of that crime, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there a difference between, in the volitional element, between the failure to protect and the act and the aiding or abetting? It seems to be one could look at those as the flip sides to the same coin. That is, you can state it in an affirmative nature that you are aiding and abetting, or you can state it in a negative nature, you are not protecting.
Yes, sir. So I disagree that they are the flip side of the same coin based on the facts here. And the reason why is that the criminal complaint does not end with Steinhardt bringing the daughter into the bedroom and then charged the two charges. It says she then remained, waited, sat on the bed, watched the three separate acts happen, and then did nothing.
Now, is it the state's position that the her part in the commission of the first-degree sexual assault was completed once she had delivered FG into the room?
Yes, the actus reus component of aiding and abetting sexual assault was completed when she brought FG into the room.
That's and correct. The mens rea.
Knowing that her husband intended to commit sexual assault, the attendant circumstance of the assault occurring obviously happened after that, yes.
Yeah. And then the actus reus for the failure to protect was her passivity.
That's correct. In the face of a duty, that's correct.
And because of that duty, that the mens rea was different there. It was a decision not to provide the aid the statute required.
That's exactly right. And as Your Honor had mentioned, Steinhardt admits that separating her acts in this way is logical, and that's at her opening brief at page 14. So it's perfectly consistent to separate these acts in this way. It's perfectly logical.
Counsel, You may not agree that they are different sides of the same coin, but let me try that in a bit of a different way. It seems to me that based on the facts presented, a court could write an opinion saying this is one continuous act or saying that, no, it's separate acts. And when you can have, I won't say two sides of the same coin because that wasn't accepted by you, but when you can have perhaps two different answers based on the same scenario presented, why doesn't the rule of lenity apply?
So the rule of lenity is a statutory interpretation question. Here we're dealing with whether these facts can be separated, particularly through the prism of the guilty plea waiver rule. And so I don't think a court could, consistent with the law, say that this was one continuous course of conduct. And the reason why is that Steinhardt admitted to the facts as alleged in the criminal complaint. And the facts alleged in the criminal complaint is that she chose to bring her daughter into the bedroom through the door, knowing what was going to happen, and then she chose to sit on the bed. She could have countered the characterization of the complaint through a trial. That was certainly her right. She chose to waive that right by pleading guilty, and therefore she has admitted that those facts are true and that they constitute liability for two distinct criminal charges here. And of particular relevance, and this was mentioned in the Court of Appeals opinion, there is no discussion of timing in the criminal complaint. Timing can be relevant to certain sexual charges that was mentioned in the Ziegler case. And since there is no discussion of timing, it has to be resolved against Ms. Steinhardt here under the guilty plea waiver rule.
Why can't you say this is an interpretation of 2P and the statute is in effect saying it's one charge, one offense, one penalty?
So we distinguish 2P because it's just identity in law, not identity in fact.
I understand
2P
that.
Uses the term.
But isn't that an interpretation? That's very unusual, isn't it, for the legislature to say that different statutes in one section of the legislation which involve different facts and different intents, et cetera, should all be treated as lesser included offenses, which means you can't charge them all, because we have a long body of law about what are lesser-included offenses, and this says, forget it. We got a new definition for 948.02.
I'm not sure if it's unusual for the legislature to do that, but it's certainly within their authority to do that as the body that defines.
Oh, I'm not checking.
Certainly.
I'm not saying they didn't have authority. I'm saying, how many times do you find that? I mean, we got dozens of offenses.
Certainly.
And we keep getting more, right?
Yes. Usually the legislature does define more crimes, yes.
So, they overlap.
Yes. They
then they overlap, right?
Oftentimes crimes overlap, but that's why 2P is helpful here.
It, right.
It's defendant-friendly in that, based on the exact same conduct, a prosecutor cannot charge a defendant with both failure to. So that would be, in that situation, two sides of the same coin.
That's right. My question to you is, you got a defendant-friendly subsection, right? So why isn't that fall within lenity?
Because the proper interpretation of it is not ambiguous as to whether, when two different crimes are committed, when two different factual circumstances underpin different charges, can they both be charged? We cited the case of Stevens from this court in our response brief at 20. In that case, it was two different drug offenses. One is a lesser included than another, but it was based on different conduct, and that's absolutely crucial. What we're saying here is that Ms. Steinhardt engaged in two distinct courses of conduct in the same evening, to be sure. However, just because they're identical in law doesn't mean she can't be charged with both of those offenses. And that's the key point here. Identity in law does not mean you can't bring both, even when the legislature specifically says they're identical in law, despite the Blockberger test. And so this is a good point to move to prong two of the Ziegler test. Steinhardt has conceded that she has the burden to show the legislature...
Just one other second.
Yes, Your Honor.
My understanding of this is that she pled no contest to all three counts, right?
That's right.
Not, she didn't plead guilty. Does that matter whether it's no contest or guilty?
That does not matter. Okay. In Kelty, it said...
All right. That,
yeah, exactly. And so in prong two of, the Ziegler test, Steinhardt has conceded that she bears the burden of showing that the legislature did not intend multiple punishments, and she cannot meet that burden. So there's four considerations on this prong. The first is the statutory language, and as we discussed, the statutes, they go at two different distinct problems here. Failure to act uses the terms has knowledge and fails to take action. Sexual assault as party to a crime uses the words intentionally aids and abets sexual contact with a minor. So the operative language shows that two different societal interests are protected. Failure to act is based on a special duty that some adults have towards children, and the sexual assault statute is based on a general duty that everyone has towards children. And so it makes perfect sense to impose two punishments on someone who violates these two duties when the violations are based on different conduct. There is no statutory prohibition stating otherwise. In terms of the legislative history that buttresses this point, the legislature made failure to act a lesser-included offense of sexual assault 18 years after creating that statute, but did not rebut the rule that charging both is allowable based on different conduct. So because the legislature stepped in and said, despite what the Blockberger test may say, we are going to make this identical in law. It's an unusual step because they did that, but they did not take a different step saying, and it doesn't matter if they're different in fact. It is permissible to infer, to the extent legislative history is helpful, that they intended the two charges to be allowable when they are based on different facts.
Do we look at the probable cause statement in the complaint here, or is that gone?
No, that's what we look
operable.
At.
Now, the state drafted that. I know it was the district attorney's office and not the Department of Justice, but it was drafted by the state.
That's correct.
It says nothing about timing, right?
That's correct.
So why isn't it your burden, that is the state's burden, to have put in enough about timing so that it supports the two counts?
Because timing alone is not the only consideration for whether these two charges, whether there is sufficient evidence for these two charges.
Is it important?
Timing may be important, but okay. It may not be, timing alone may not even be sufficient. It's just one consideration. And what's important here, Steinhardt read the criminal complaint. She told the court she read the criminal complaint. She admitted that the complaints were true, that the facts in the complaint were true.
Yeah, and they are as far as they go. It's just they don't state every fact.
Perhaps so, but what's most important is not only does she admit they are true, she admits that they are legally sufficient to support all the charges that she pled no contest to. And that's the important point here. That's why it is appropriate under the guilty plea waiver rule to require her to show that the complaint cannot be construed in a manner consistent with the double jeopardy clause. So the guilty plea really is the crux of this case. That's where we satisfy both the truth of the facts asserted, but also the legal sufficiency of those facts for supporting all of the charges here. And so just to finish up these prongs of the Ziegler test, we have the nature of the prescribed conduct. As I said, one is an act of commission, is an act of omission. And the final criteria here is the appropriateness of multiple punishments. And what Ziegler said about multiple sexual assaults applies here as well. This is a quote. It is hard to imagine a series of acts that is more appropriately subject to cumulative punishments. That applies here as well as in Ziegler. So summarizing the test, prong one is resolved against Steinhardt because the charges are different in fact. And she has not met her burden on prong two to show a contrary legislative intent. Therefore, there is no multiplicity problem here, and all the charges can stand.
Let me take your difference in fact argument and push it back to the charge of aiding and abetting first degree sexual assault as a party to the crime. The two charges are, as I just indicated, the first degree sexual assault as a party to the crime and failure to act how far can you push back this fact situation so that they are one and the same?
I think so. There is an inevitable line drawing problem with any multiplicity claim because we are, of course, asking the question of when are the facts sufficiently different. Mm-hmm. And here, what's important is that the criminal complaint does not end with an allegation that she entered the room knowing what was going to happen. It then says she stayed there and watched as the three sexual assaults occurred.
Okay, if she would have stayed for one sexual assault, same facts or different facts?
That would support the same charges. Yes, different.
Okay.
Those would have been different facts than here, mm-hmm. but they would support the same charges. That's correct.
And if she had brought the child into the room and waited for a while, but certainly enough time to, as the element of the offense requires, take action that would have prevented the sexual assault. Say she waited 3 minutes before the first sexual assault, or 2 minutes, or 1 minute. That's sufficient time to say, no, this has to stop. So, would it be separate acts in your mind under a fact situation if she had waited 1 minute and then left the room?
As long as there is an allegation in the complaint that is admitted to or admitted to by the defendant or found by a fact finder at a trial, that Steinhardt knew that there was going to that someone intended to have a sexual assault to sexually assault the child and was physically and emotionally capable of preventing assault, then yes, that would be.
But the next element is then failed to take action that would have prevented it. In that 60 seconds, she could have taken action to prevent it. So isn't your answer to my question that yes, even though she waited 60 seconds, under your analysis, she still would be subjected, even though she left before any sexual assault occurred, she still would be subjected to it under your analysis, that is, to two charges.
Let me take a second go at that. That's a valid point. It's she knew someone intended, she failed to take action to prevent it, and she could have taken that action. That's correct. There has to be those three other elements. As long as there are those allegations in the complaint read in at a plea hearing or found by a fact finder, then yes, that would support two charges.
So if the facts were that those three elements were met, she knew what was going on, she was physically and emotionally, as the
correct.
Law requires, capable of preventing it, and she did nothing to prevent it, I'm paraphrasing now,
correct.
During the 60 seconds that she was there before she left the room and before any sexual assault occurred, your argument and our law in the next case could say she is guilty of both offenses for staying there for 60 seconds without doing anything.
Right, and knowing that sexual assault would occur. Yeah, yes, that's correct. And now, if you're a jury and the prosecutor says, my basis for her knowing and having the ability to act are based on these 60 seconds alone, I as a juror might conclude that a reasonable person cannot choose to act in that short span of time, and therefore perhaps she's guilty of aiding and abetting by bringing the daughter, but not guilty of failure to act. However, here, Steinhardt admitted to the facts in the criminal complaint. There is no mention of timing, and because of the guilty plea waiver rule, that is resolved in favor of upholding the verdict.
I'm going to take you back a minute from Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's example. She doesn't even go into the room. She knows what's going to happen. She leaves the daughter at the door or pushes her in and doesn't come in. Two crimes or one?
If there is an allegation in the criminal complaint that she knew and was capable of stopping, there's nothing magic about the threshold of the room. And that's
right.
Consistent with the Carol M.D. case, where the mother in that case left her son with, I believe it was her boyfriend, and the sexual assaults occurred when I believe she was even at work.
Well, we can even go farther back and further back in time and say the mother knows what's going to happen and just tells the girl to go into the bedroom. Two crimes, one crime, no crime.
If the mother told the girl what was going, or knew what was going to happen,
knew what was going to happen,
ordered
says
the girl,
to the girl,
yep.
Go in the bedroom. That's what your obligation is tonight or today.
And if the
one crime, two crime, everything else is the same.
With the additional allegations, that would still be two crimes if the defendant admitted to the facts, or if a fact finder found them as
well,
such
at
trial.
We don't have a fact finder here. We're just going on the complaint and information.
So if it's just a complaint information, if we don't have either a bench verdict or a jury verdict or a plea of guilty or no contest or an Alford
I'm
plea.
I'm sorry. All the facts are the same. We're relying on the complaint and information and a no contest plea.
Then yes, that would support two crimes because we have the allegations of all the elements, mm-hmm. because Ms. Steinhardt was presented with the probable cause portion in the criminal complaint, which was built upon by the information. She admitted to all those at the plea hearing. That is sufficient to say the truth of the facts asserted and also the legal sufficiency legal sufficiency to support all the charges here.
Counsel, there's another issue that's in this case that no one has talked about, and since this is your only opportunity for oral argument, I'd like you to address it, and that is whether counsel provided ineffective assistance in failing to advise his client of the double jeopardy potential.
Yes, Your Honor. So the ineffective assistance claim is wholly dependent upon the multiplicity claim. So the test for ineffective assistance is deficient performance and prejudice. The alleged deficient performance here is counsel's failure to raise the double jeopardy defense, the multiplicity claim. Ms. Steinhardt has said that that is the exact same claim that she has also asserted just on the merits that we've all been discussing this morning. And so if that claim is resolved against Ms. Steinhardt, if the court concludes that, in fact, there is no valid double jeopardy claim, then counsel cannot have been ineffective for failing to argue that claim to the circuit court. And therefore, the ineffective assistance claim is simply done, resolved on the merits against Ms. Steinhardt.
Well, let's assume you lose it and that it was that this was really one fact situation. And it shouldn't have been charged to two. So counsel was ineffective. Was there prejudice?
Yes, that's right. The state has conceded prejudice.
Why?
The state has conceded prejudice because Ms. Steinhardt, by her plea, has obtained a separate conviction that has put her in jail for an additional period of time. Now, of course, we do not think there is a double jeopardy problem
here. I understand
that. If there is, then yes, she has been prejudiced.
What does the court do? Does the court just strike 10 years off it, or does it have to go back to the trial court?
The court would vacate the duplicitous conviction, which in this case I believe is charge one, is her only challenge. And the court, in its discretion, could either remand for resentencing or could just simply vacate the sentence. The state hasn't taken a position on that particular component.
Unfortunately, I've had a lot of sexual assault trials, pleas, convictions, sentencings as a trial court judge. I'm trying to recall a case where the offender was, who might be a stepfather, if we're using the facts of this case, was also charged with failure to act. Could that be the subject of two counts for the offender?
No. Based on the statute as written for failure to act, it requires the adult with the duty to know another person is going to commit the assault. So the person who commits the assault cannot also be guilty of failure to act to stop the assault by the terms of the statute.
Are you finished?
Yes.
Justice Ziegler's question, though, was in my mind, because it seems, as you indicated, a lot of this jurisprudence really boils down to line drawing, quite frankly. And you're drawing the line too close, not on the facts of this case, but on your argument and the law that you're advocating that can be applied in other cases. almost to the point of the question just asked. Hey, can the perpetrator be charged with failure to act? Now, the statute says for another, so you have a nice and comfortable answer there. But it seems to me that the almost anyone who is charged with aiding and abetting, if you will, first-degree sexual assault can also be convicted for failure to act.
So, 2 points to that, Your Honor. The first is that failure to act only attaches to adults with a duty to the child. Normally, okay. That is parents.
Okay. Let's say any mother. Let's get specific then. Any mother charged with aiding and abetting will, regardless of the time, regardless of the number of things, regardless of the facts of the sexual assault, other than sexual assault occurred, any mother is any parent, you know, any guardian is automatically guilty of a second offense because they didn't do anything to stop it when they are a person charged with responsibility, knew what was going on, that is, an emotionally and physically capable of stopping it, and not stopping it. Regardless of the timing, regardless of the number, the aiding and abetting in and of itself makes this second one almost a status offense. You're charged with welfare, you're guilty of the second offense. You're going too far, it seems to me. Tell me why you're not going too far.
No, I don't think that's correct, Your Honor.
I know you don't think it's correct, but tell me why.
Fair enough. In all of these cases, there needs to be the actual time after the action of aiding and abetting, that time. The law ascribes a duty to parents in that instance. The law expects parents to protect their children from people who are going to sexually assault them when they are physically and emotionally capable of doing that. Now, the fact that that would probably occur in most of these failure to act cases when it is also combined with a assisting sexual assault, that does not raise a double jeopardy issue. That is just a recognition that oftentimes crimes have foreseeable consequences, and failure to mitigate those foreseeable consequences can result in additional crimes. The line that we are drawing here is certainly no closer to a problem than the line that has been consistently affirmed by courts across the country, that conspiracy to commit an offense is a separable, chargeable, and convicted crime to actually committing the offense.
Is conspiracy different than aiding and abetting?
Yes, conspiracy is different from aiding and abetting.
So did you use the word conspiracy carefully?
I did, yes.
Is this a conspiracy case or does it matter?
No, it's not a conspiracy case, and it doesn't matter for affirming the conviction here. My only point is that under the Double Jeopardy Clause, lines are drawn exceptionally close under some circumstances, like the difference between conspiring to commit a crime and committing that actual crime. That is just black-letter law that can be affirmed under the Double Jeopardy Clause. And here, we're drawing the line between aiding and abetting sexual assault, and then, as the time goes on and you see sexual assaults happen, failing to act to stop the sexual assault when you're physically capable of doing it and when you have the duty to prevent it.
What's the maximum penalty here?
I do not have that with me. I believe for sexual assault.
It's an F felony.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
And the sexual assault is a B felony. So there's a difference in penalty.
Yes, that's right. And that's why under the 936.661 is a lesser included than the other. That's why failure to act is the lesser included, because it is a less severe felony.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief
Justice, if I could ask just a really brief question.
Yes.
Thank you. Following up on Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question of the failure to protect potentially being a status crime, I'm wondering if you could tell me whether Ms. Steinhardt had brought FG to the door and allowed her to go in, if she could have avoided being charged with failure to protect if she then went through the door herself and brought her back out.
If she went in through the door herself and brought her back out, and the implication is that prevented the sexual assault or mitigated the unreasonable risk,
yes,
then yes, that we would not have that final element of the offense.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
wanted to start by addressing the state's position in its argument here that if there's any separation in time, even if it's a moment, if the parent of a child did not act to stop a sexual assault, that they could be charged with both the act of sexual assault itself as party to a crime and also the failure to act. I think that that is not what the legislature intended to do when they passed these statutes in 1985, and then when they also created 93966 subsection 2P. I don't think that that was their intention. The legislature could have and did not specifically exclude failure to act from 93966 subsection 2P. The legislature included that and said, no, you can't be convicted of both the higher and lesser included offense in 94802, all parts of 94802.
Counsel, does the failure to act, the elements require that the sexual assault actually occurs? I look at the jury instruction, Wisconsin jury instruction 2106, and the final element, number 7, says the defendant's alleged failure to act, then bracket, expose the child to an unreasonable risk that sexual intercourse contact may occur. And I look at that, and I am uncertain if your opposing counsel's, what I've heard, if I heard it correctly, suggestion that the element is required that it did occur. Can you help enlighten me? I need some enlightenment. Does the charge of sexual assault of a child, failure to act to prevent sexual intercourse or sexual contact, require that sexual contact or intercourse occur?
I think it does require that it occur. When you look at the other elements of the offense, it talks about that the victim was under the age of 16 at the time of the alleged offense. But then also going down to the number 5 in the jury instruction, it talks about that the defendant was capable of taking action that would have prevented the sexual assault from taking place or being repeated. I think that it contemplates that it would occur. There is no specific element that requires that it occur. I think that the legislature intended that there be some sort of act. I think practically speaking, if it didn't require any sort of act actually occur, I think that the amount of failure to act charges that you could be charged with, knowing that, say, in the Carol M.D. case, where the mother, over the course of several months, left her child alone with his assaulter, she was charged with each time the father actually did sexually assault the child, not each time she actually left the child in the care of the person who assaulted the boy. So I don't think that the legislature intended that it just be allowed to be charged in a situation where a parent created this unreasonable risk. Now, I think that the legislature did not intend to allow, as the state's talking about, having a failure to act charge and a first degree, or I'm sorry, an act of commission sexual assault charge for a situation where a parent had left the child in the care of someone who is going to assault the child. I think it seems unreasonable that the actual assaulter is only able to be charged with one offense and that the parent who left the child alone therefore only gets an additional penalty. I don't think that that's what the legislature intended to do when they enacted the 93966 subsection 2P.
If you were to prevail, do you think this case should go back for resentencing on the other count?
Well, I think that there hasn't been a set standard. The court talks about this in State versus Robinson, about what the remedy would be in this sort of situation. In cases where there is a negotiated plea agreement, the court in Robinson talks about that essentially the defendant pursuing this appeal equals a substantial breach of a plea agreement, so that the party should then be returned to the point of the plea being entered, with the parties then free to negotiate for any sort of new plea agreement. I think that Robinson leaves it open to where there shouldn't be a set rule. I think in this case, the appropriate remedy would be to vacate count one, the lesser included charge, and to not return the case for resentencing. I don't think that would be necessary in this case.
Well, I would understand why you wouldn't want resentencing, but why shouldn't it be returned, if you're correct on this, why shouldn't it be returned to that position where the plea was entered and before sentencing for the judge to consider the gravity of the offense, the character of the offender, and the need to protect the public, and go through the appropriate factors for the offense for which she's convicted?
Well, I think that the court already did that at the sentencing hearing. The argument is that this is a multiplicitous charge, so it's essentially exposing her to additional punishment she otherwise shouldn't have been exposed to. So in this situation where there was no negotiated plea agreement, the court had all of these facts before it. The court had the opportunity to sentence her for more on the first-degree charge, but did not. So we would be asking the court in this circumstance where Ms. Steinhardt is exercising her right to challenge these the multiplicitous charge on appeal, that she not be returned then to the court so that a change may then be made in her sentence that could penalize her. That wouldn't be appropriate in this case.
Thank you very much.
I thought there were cases that said you look to see the vacating of a particular charge changes the trial court's theory of punishment and what he was attempting to do.
You may answer the question. Yes.
Thank you. That is true, and I think in this circumstance that analysis would lead the court to not change the sentence, because what the count essentially did was just create an additional punishment for the same act. I mean, that's what we would be arguing here.
All right. Thank you. And thanks to both counsel for very, very good briefs and for fine arguments. It's always a help to the court when counsel can add so much to our discussions. We're going to take a brief recess now because we have another group of students coming in and some that may wish to leave. So we'll adjourn for a few minutes until we get prepared to start again with our second case of the morning. We are adjourned.